This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
People say to me now, John, we don't recognise you with your clothes on.
was that as nerve-wracking as going like into chemo? I mean, which was the scariest bit?
A little bit anxious and a few nerves, but you know what? We've all got one.
You've got three ladies here who don't.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's fair to say you got your fair share.
Hello and welcome to You, Me and the Big C. Bowel Babies here, Deborah James. Yes. I've got Lauren Mahn with me.
Woo-woo!
From Girl Versus Cancer. I'm Rachel Bland. You hear me on 5 Live presenting the news sometimes. I also write the blog Big C Little Me. The three of us, we're all
firm friends, I think it's fair to say now.
Bosom buds.
Yeah, we all met through blogging about our cancer. We want to tell you all about the highs that you get going through cancer treatment as well as the lows. Just a reminder before we start, you can get in touch, suggest future topics for us, things you'd like to hear us talk about. Use the hashtag YouMeBigC. It works across all forms of social media. We do try and read them all. Now, before we move on, we should just say this is the first time that we've all met up and had the chance to properly chat about what went down last week, because we got the boot from the studio halfway through last week.
We went and drank champagne.
We did.
Yeah, we did. And we left my husband, Steve, your dad, Alistair, Deb, and your brother, Ryan, Lauren, along with Jonathan Agnew, to kind of talk about how they were feeling. Steve and I listened to it that night.
On the Wednesday. I was there at midnight going, with my husband.
We sat on the sofa, both just kind of sat there listening. And it was just so just so many of the things that he said, I was like, sorry.
I got really emotional. I got really emotional. My dad said something about the first time he had heard me say something was on the podcast. And you forget, actually, I forget that I talk probably more openly on the podcast than I do with my parents, my husband.
And then you kind of forget who's listening. You forget that they're listening.
And my husband really related to Steve.
That's
so, which I thought was really good, because people always sometimes think, they're alone with their fears, and actually, he listened to the podcast, listened to Steve, and went, I feel like that too.
Yeah, and it is just that kind of recognizing things, and it was quite hard for me to hear some of the things that Steve had kind of felt and been through, because I think he's really, tried to be that pillar of strength as much as he can through everything. So it is. It was great for him, I think, to have that time to talk to the other guys and actually get that out, and a bit of therapy for him as well.
So. Yeah, I was well emotional. Like, I was listening to it at home, because me and my brother obviously live in separate places, and I listened to it, and just hearing him talking about him going and having to need space broke my heart, because I'm his big sister. I'm like, I protect you. If things make you sad, I'll make you laugh. But I was the thing making him sad. It was, which is fine. Like, it is what it is. But it really did. My little heart broke a little bit. I was like, my bubba. But it's really important we talk about it. And I'm really proud of them all for coming in. Opening up, because it's not an easy thing to do, especially on a big forum like this. So
I love
well
the way
done,
that
boys.
Jonathan especially was just like, I was struggling with something, so I went to the GP, and he said it in a way where there's no shame. There shouldn't be any shame anyway, but he was, he's a big strapping lad, isn't he? Lad, that sounds like, that big strapping lad. But you know what I mean? He kind of came in and he said, well, actually, you know what? I was really struggling at one point and I just took myself to the GP, and actually that really helped. And I think to say that in that manner will help so many people, because making that first step in terms of admitting it sometimes. And if he can do it, anyone can, right?
It's knowing you're not the only one, and I think they've done a great thing.
So thank you, boys.
Today we're going to be talking about the doctors, the relationship between ourselves and our medical teams. But before we get into all that, let's have a quick catch up. Deborah, last week on the podcast, we heard you had your clear CT scan.
Clear CT scan.
We celebrated.
And I very meanly surprised my father. I'd lied to my mum. My mum was just like, why'd you do that? Surprised my father. And then I had a PET scan, which is kind of where you become like a hotspot, like a heat map.
Radioactive. So it's a bit like a CT scan, but more detailed. You get like a radioactive injection.
It tells the doctors about slightly different things. So it kind of says whether your cancer or cancer cells are active in your body. And that was clear.
Yay!
Which means that I'm officially, and I've got to stop always saying this, haven't I? I always go, well, it might only be for a day. Yeah. It means I'm officially in remission.
Which is just amazing.
It is amazing.
Where you are, you know, for a stage four cancer patient to get into remission is a pretty...
It's pretty. So I had I had 7 tumours removed from my lungs and then my bowel tumour as well. And so to go from my starting point to this point is amazing. And that's because of the team of people that have been working with me. Yeah. And I've put my utter faith in them. So I think it's really, really relevant today, our topic.
Yeah. And it's kind of a relatively new procedure that you had. Like the last few years, your lung ablation that you were having that got rid of those lung tumours, it's quite a new thing.
Absolutely. I've had procedures done that maybe 3 years ago wouldn't have actually been considered. So I had a thoracotomy where they essentially removed part of my lungs. Mm. And then I've also had ablation, which is where they kind of burn tumours out. And that is relatively new. It's only available in a select few centres across the country. And, you know, arguably it is a trial phase thing. I don't know whether the tumours are going to come back, but...
Were you ever worried? Like, were you ever really nervous about it? Because it's quite a new procedure. Were you ever like, oh, yeah, do it, but don't do it?
No, I think that the person who was doing it on me is incredibly experienced in his field and, you know, is one of the leaders in it. So therefore, you just think, well, I'm in the best hands.
How does it feel? Because you were talking in previous podcasts about how you just really wanted a break because you've been on continuous treatment. So much chemo has been thrown at you and you just really wanted a break. So how does it feel?
So honestly, it feels like a holiday. So mentally, though, so I'm like, woohoo. And then I'm like, oh, I'm knackered. So there's this misconception. I was talking the other night about this, that everyone assumes your cancer treatment, your active cancer treatment ends. But then, and I know we've discussed this in previous kind of pods, that actually the emotions catch up with you. I think I'm in post-traumatic stress. Yeah,
it's a very, very common side effect of going through, other than the physical, the mental side effect is that you literally spend most of your life going, la, 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 life's great. And then you go, what just happened here?
And this is what I've heard from a lot of people who've been through cancer treatment and have been clear for some time afterwards, that they say it's almost harder afterwards. Like once, you know, you just, when you're on the treadmill, you're just getting on with
it. You just get on with it, don't you?
It's when you're sort of left with your thoughts and
you know where you stand
adrift afterwards.
You do, you know where you stand. I always say cancer's like this little like lurker by the door. So like yours is outside the door now. But he's still peeking. He's like, oi, what are you up to in there? Can I come in? You're like, back away. That's what it feels like. It's just always peeping its head round. You can never quite shake it off.
And I think I'm in a position where, because of the fact that it had metastasized statistically, there is a, I mean, it's a crazy statistic, but basically it's likely to come back. And so in the same sentence that my oncologist said, you're in remission, he then said, should we talk about maintenance chemo? Which is essentially where you were on a lower dose chemo to try and kick the can as far down the road as you possibly can. He doesn't know what's going to happen to me. Mm. I don't know what's going to happen to me. On a piece of paper, it doesn't look great. However, it looks great today. So I'm not one for going, I'm cancer free. But at the same time, I think I need to get my mindset into going, well, for the moment I am.
Babe.
Because in 6 weeks, I've got a scan in 6 weeks' time.
Yeah, but every
and
time
it can
you
all
get
end
a
then.
Clear. Yeah, but that's what I mean. But for now, the next 6 weeks, live in these 6 weeks, babe.
Yeah.
Own them, enjoy them. Because as far as you're concerned, cancer-free.
Because I think that's the problem. If I get a scan, say I've got another scan in 6 weeks, because we're just doing really, really close monitoring.
Yeah.
And if something comes back, I'm going to be really annoyed with myself.
But let's work on the proviso that it's not.
Okay.
And the more of those clear scans you have, the easier
the better.
That is going to be, isn't it? So
let's... We'll think positively. I always plan for the worst. But
celebrate while we can. Have you brought champagne today?
No.
We'll have tea then. Cheers, babes.
We'll have a cup of tea. I'm trying really hard and failed this Tuesday already to give my liver a bit of a break. Well, at least on a Monday.
One day off a week. That's what I need.
One day off a week, which is better than where I was. So I got one step at a time.
You kind of got to this place through all of the expert medical team that you've got. And that's kind of who we're talking about today is the relationship between us and the people who are fighting to keep us alive. So we've heard a bit about your team. We'll get more into detail about your team, Deb. Lauren, who was involved in your care? Let's like talk through, because I imagine your care, your team setup was probably similar to mine because we're both breast cancer.
Yeah, initially my diagnosis, I was diagnosed at different hospitals where I'm now treated at the Marsden. So I was diagnosed at Homerton Hospital and I had a consultant who was very straight.
Like, I said this in a previous pod, I knew I had cancer before they told me officially I had cancer because of her, because the way she was so matter of fact. Like, when I went in, she went, right, okay, so we found something suspicious. We've done a biopsy. When you come back next week, if it's cancer, it will be an MRI and a CT scan. And that's all she said. And I went, but what if it's not? She just said, have you had a trauma to the breast? And I was like, what? No. She went, bring someone with you. And I remember thinking, all right, I hate you, you're a cow. But at the same time, I was quite grateful because when I went back to her and actually got my result and she was like, I'm sorry, it's bad news, it's cancer.
You'd already been in that place.
I kind of was in that place. But also when I burst out crying and said, I don't want to die, she went, you're not going to. And because of how straight she is, yeah. I totally have faith in, what I believed what she said.
And so was she your surgeon?
She was a consultant.
Yeah, so she's a consultant.
She was a consultant. Surgeon. Yeah, I don't know what she was. She had consultant Dr. Choi. But she was amazing. And she was just like, no, this is the plan. And she automatically went, because my family are based in the other side of London, she went, do you want a referral to elsewhere? And that's when I got referred. But at the Marsden, I was under Fiona McNeil.
And was that something that was in your mind at the time? Oh, the Royal Marsden, that's a good place to go and get treated for cancer because it's a world leader.
It was my mum. My mum's automatic reaction was, let's get her back down the other end of London so I can take care of her. But it just so happens that my parents don't live too far from the Marsden in Chelsea.
Yeah.
So that we put that as a first choice. And we're like, if we don't get there, then we've got Charing Cross and loads of other hospitals nearby. So it was just, I feel very fortunate that I got in as NHS there. But it was my mum. I was just like, what the hell's going on? My mum was like, let's get her back.
Yeah, because you always feel fortunate if you do live near. Yeah. So I'm near the Christie Hospital in Manchester. Again, you know, it's the Marsden and the Christie are the sort of two big, you know, world-leading hospitals in the UK in terms of cancer care. And I think we should point out as well to people that you've got a huge team involved in your care. Mm-hmm. So for me, at the hospitals I was at, a surgeon sort of leads the start of your care. So a breast surgeon is the one who will do the initial diagnosis, all the tests, the CT scans and order all that kind of thing. And they look after the operative side of things. And then working alongside them, you have an oncologist. So two consultant
that's why I was
surgeons.
Confused. It's a surgical consultant and an oncology consultant, right?
Yeah.
I still get confused.
And then if it gets even... So I actually am under the care of about 5 different consultants. So I have one oncologist who oversees all my care. And everything goes through him and he's amazing. And he's based at the Marsden, but then he is not, say, a lung specialist.
Yeah.
So because my, cancer spread to my lungs, I was then referred to the Brompton, and my operations was with one of the best surgeons at the Brompton. And so now, like on Monday, my chest is killing me today. It's just what happens when you're zapped left, right, and centre. And so I went to see another lung specialist who deals with one person cuts you open and causes, they don't cause any problems.
Yeah. But fixes the fallout.
Yeah, and then another part, then you go to see another consultant who fixes the fallout and goes, well, that is what happens when your lung kind of, you've had so many operations. So I feel really blessed that actually they're not trying to be a jack of all trades. You know, we have highly specialised people who are dealing with every single little strand.
Yeah, so this whole team of people can be involved, and beyond then the kind of the surgeon and the consultant. So Lauren and I would have what are called breast care nurses. Did you have something on a similar level?
So that's
a kind of, so I've got one that works with my surgeon and one that works with my oncologist, and they're both specially trained nurses. They're at the end of a phone line.
They need them Friday, and
they're just like, right, call us if you need appointments arranging. If you feel like you need a scan, you need to get in touch with the doctors. Yeah. Call us, and they're always there. And I have a one-to-one relationship with them. So do you have like
mine's slightly different setup, but I think that's just the way maybe my oncologist works. So I'm under his direct care, so everything goes through him or his personal secretary, and then she will direct me to whoever I might need to go to. But the bottom line, I mean, Lauren was sitting next to me on the train, and I'm booking appointments left, right, and centre. But you can always get to see the people that you need to see.
I will quite frequently harassed secretaries of my surgeon. Yeah. And we were going to speak to my surgeon later as well. He made the mistake of giving me his telephone number at some point.
I'm like that with my nurse, if I'm honest. My breast cancer nurse, Denise, God bless Denise, she's amazing. But I feel like she's my right-hand woman. I feel like she's family. Even now, when I'm like kind of the process of going out the other end, further and further away, even now, she's probably got a lot more important cases to deal with. I'll still be emailing her going, so Denise, there's this pain in my leg, or there's this pain here, or I think this is happening. And she'll always come back and always reassure me.
Yeah,
she's amazing.
They're great, aren't they? Yeah. You know, everybody from, you know, the breast care team to even up to consultant level, if you've got a good relationship with them, then they will always come back to you and put your mind at rest.
And the chemo stuff as well. Like we said this, you know, we had Kate on, didn't we?
Yes, when
we
did
the
chemo. Chemo-ness.
I've got such a great relationship with everyone in the medical day unit there, from everyone who serves me the tea, to does the bloods, the receptionist. Like, I know them now. Yeah. It's so weird. They just become such a big part of your cancer life. And they actually buzz off seeing you go back in and like going, oh my God, how are you doing? And it is a really special bond, I think, you form over those few months.
Yeah. You don't have a choice, do you?
No.
Because it is really important, isn't it, to have trust in your medical team.
Yeah.
That's the number one thing. If you don't trust the people looking after you, because you know they're the experts. We Google a bit, but our knowledge is really, really patchy compared to theirs. That's a kind way of putting it. So how important is it for you guys to really trust what your team are doing?
100% it is. Like for me, I've been quite fortunate in that when I went to the Marsden, I was referred to Fiona McNeil, and she's like top dog. I was gonna say the B word then. She's top dog in her field in like breast surgery, and like she does loads of stuff. She writes in the Times and things like that. I felt safe straight away. She was like sat down with me. I actually walked into an office and went, take them both off. And they looked at me like, what? And I was like, take them both off, because I don't want to go through this again. They went, no, we're not going to do that. And I was like, well, why? And when they explained to me, all of a sudden I was like, oh, you guys really know what you're doing. You know what you're going to do? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there's a reason. I don't know. I just automatically... I was in such a panic before I actually had my proper like meetings with my surgical consultants and stuff, that when they actually went through everything and they were so matter of fact and really clear, and they, do you know what? They just never made me feel worried. Like, they weren't worried about me, so I wasn't worried about me.
Yeah.
They were just like, let's get this bit done, then we can move on to this bit. And it really did. I trusted them, and I did. There was nothing in my mind that made me think this wasn't going to be okay, because I trusted the decision they've made.
When I first met my oncologist, he's going to hate me for saying this, but he's incredibly passionate about what he does. But he wants everything. He wants to know the full picture, and he wants, the best of the best. So if somebody has read the scans, for example, he wants them read by a member of his team that he knows and he trusts.
Yeah.
And it's taken me a while to get used to that way of working. But what I realise is, because he works like that, he gives the most incredible kind of care. But when I first met him, I, like Lauren, was actually diagnosed at another hospital. And it was only when we realised that it was maybe a little bit kind of more advanced than we initially thought that I got referred to the Marsden. And I first met him, and bearing in mind that I thought I had bowel cancer, which I do, and I just had my bowel tumour removed, the first thing he said to me was, right, so let's talk about your lungs. And I thought, well, what do you mean? And nobody had said to me that basically on one of my previous scans, there had been like a little nodule that had appeared. And because he is so pedantic about checking the scans so thoroughly, as far as he was concerned, my primary tumour had been removed. And what he wanted to know was, is he looking at a stage 3 patient or is he looking at a stage 4 patient?
Yeah, because they've got to know what they're dealing
they've
with.
They've got to know. And that is exactly... And so his attitude was like, right, I need to go. I'm not trusting any of these scans. I want them read by my guys. Right, you straight up, straight from UCTs, everything was reread. It wasn't kind of slagging off the previous hospital. Mm. It was just that is the way that he works.
Yeah.
And as a result... it meant that my scans, I have incredibly tiny tumours on my lungs, but because they were read by a highly specialised team of people
who know what they're looking for,
my tumours were picked up arguably before, you know, anyone else would have recognised them. But it did take me back. And I remember walking out of like the first appointment, bearing in mind that I just thought I was going to have a bit of mop-up chemo. You know, my tumour was out. I was going to have 6 months of chemo, wham, bam, out the door. And I walked out going, oh, what do you mean my lungs? And I was totally blindsided, wanted to run away from the Marsden, not because it's not a great place, I was just overwhelmed.
Yeah, but it's almost when someone's giving you that kind of level of bad news, you blame them. This is your fault.
What do you mean? Just don't look for it. You know, if you don't look for it, you're not going to find.
I read something that you'd written quite early on that you talked about, and I don't know, was this your oncologist that you said, he'd said to you, I will treat you like my daughter.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that was such a nice thing
really?
To say. What it a lovely actually, thing to hear
so
from
funny
your
enough,
doctor.
So that was actually my surgeon who said that to me, and he when he was, bearing in mind that you've just told that you have cancer, you then referred to a surgeon who's going to tell you that they're going to chop you open. I'm somebody who was scared of needles, had never really even had an operation. And he turned around and said to me, look, you don't have to choose me as a consultant. He said, you have a choice, but he said, I promise you that I will treat you like a daughter. And he was the best person I could have referred to. And then my current oncologist, when we found out it spread, he said to me, I will do everything in my power to keep you alive.
I think that's such a great thing to hear from a medical person who's looking after you.
Yeah.
How reassuring.
Yeah. And so it was kind of, this is a crap situation. You've got stage 4 bowel cancer, but you know what? We're going to throw the kitchen sink and all at it.
What kind of manner do you girls prefer from your doctor? So for me, I changed my medical team, and I'll come on to that when we talk about getting a second opinion, because I did go and do that. And I different people like different things. So I hate it when medical people look at me sympathetically. Mm. I don't want your sympathy. If they tilt the head and like, oh, we're really sorry, it's very bad news. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. I just want, and this is what I get from my surgeon now, is I just want, you know, it delivered with a straight face, obviously with compassion. You don't want someone who doesn't have any feeling, but I don't like it when medical people put their own emotions into my diagnosis, because that makes me feel really bad. So I just prefer someone who is, you know, straight down the line, right, this is what we found and this is how we're going to deal with it.
This is the plan of action.
And this is what we're going to do. Yeah. And that I just much, much prefer that kind of thing. But I know there are other people who, the kind of doctors that I like, would find them, they're not feeling enough. They're not giving me enough empathy for my situation.
No, see, I'm probably the same as you, is that I like people to be very straight. I don't want this like all stuff, but they need to be comfortable with how informal I am as a human being, because I am a super informal human being. I will make inappropriate jokes. I will swear. I will do that. I don't do formality very well.
Yeah.
So I need a doctor that's knows me and knows that's how I am and is all right with it. Because like, there's been times, we'll come on to things like about like the funny things that have happened, but I've said things to doctors and they've looked at me like, pardon? And it is quite a common like trend. So that's what I look for in someone. I need someone who's like compassionate, but very professional, and is just, who just knows me and makes me feel comfortable. And I know they're going to manage me the way I need to be managed.
Okay.
Relationship.
I like winding up my oncologist because he's very straight laced. Well, he's not. I don't think underneath it he is, but he's quite straight laced when they're trying to have a conversation and you're sat on the chemo ward in an orange cat suit. and he's like, and you know, he doesn't want to say anything, and you're just like, yeah, hi, and nobody,
just not commenting on the cat
suit. Don't comment, you just carry on. Like, yeah, I know. Or like for me, it was a Christmas Father Claus outfit, poo outfit, whatever went.
So you two are so naughty. I kind of go into these like medical situations and appointments feeling a bit like I'm going to see the headmaster at school. So I sit there kind of like, yes, no, yes, please, yes, thank you very much. And you know, I don't cry, wait until I just yep, nod, wait till I get out, like, just, you know, explode with emotion. I never say the wrong thing. I don't, careful, don't swear in front of the consultants.
Oh, they've heard it all with me.
What kind of things have you said to your team?
Well, the initial thing, and I've talked about this a lot, when I first got diagnosed with cancer and I walked into the room and they was like, really serious, Macmillan nurse stood there. I'm really sorry, Lauren, it's bad news, it is cancer. And I just went, what the sorry, I'm gonna boing that. And boing. And I was like, what? And then I went, I can't have effing breast cancer, I don't have any effing tits. And the consultant was looking at me like, and my mum going like, is this girl for real? I was like, no, seriously though, I don't have breasts, how can I have breast cancer? And then when she kind of got what I was like, she kind of settled into me. But that was my way of coping with that dramatic thing. I've had incident, like when I've been in before for like initial biopsies and ultrasounds and whatever. So I'm just going to pass Rachel my fan. I believe there's a hot flush happening in the room.
Oh, I'm about to start stripping. Get my knockers out.
Yeah, literally. When I went into like one of my first biopsies at the Marsden, there was like an older gentleman there, like, and he's like, if you just like, you know, undo your robe, I'm so scared of my boobs. I was like, and I say that, I'm like, I'm used to getting my out, mate, don't worry.
Another boy.
Yeah. And I pull
going
back.
For a record.
Yeah. I can see Mike going, oh, too many bongs going on,
Dad.
Today.
I like pull back my gown, and then he put the jelly on to like do the ultrasound, like to guide the biopsy. And I went, oh, that's warm. And he went to me, it's because you're at the Marsden, dear. And I was like, yes, this is my guy. So there's just been loads of things like that, really.
But it does take, I don't know about you, but when I first presented maybe to my oncologist, I wasn't in the best state because you have to kind of settle into the idea, A, you have cancer, and B, what lies ahead. And, you know, we've talked before about port insertion. I know that Rachel's got port and so I've got port.
Intravenous catheter.
And when somebody said to me, I'm just sitting here with like, and I literally was talking about getting my knockers out and I'm sitting here. It's not my boobs. I'm just sitting here. Oh, totally inappropriate.
You're meant to waft you with the fan.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you can tell it's one of those days today, isn't it? But I can't even remember what I was saying now. Oh, yeah. When I first met him, I think he thought, I don't know, well, maybe he liked me, but I didn't like myself retrospectively because I was a little bit of a princess that kind of was like, well, I'm not going to have one of those ports. Do we have to? What's the alternative? And you kind of start not coming down to it, but I think it's accepting the fact that you need to trust the team because they know what's best for you. And if you've got a little stuck-up princess waltzing into the room with her high heels and her hat going, well, can't we just have a little bit of mop-up chemo? And they're kind of looking at you going, love, we're currently debating whether you've got tumours in your lungs. And you're throwing a hissy fit over whether you're going to have another little operation to put in a port. And I'm telling you that this is good for you. It's almost like, can somebody else deal with her? I think that was almost the very polite comment as he turned to the... it was the nurse specialist at the time. It was kind of, do we have an alternative?
Get her out of my consulting room.
It was almost, well, can somebody else just converse? And you do realise that actually they're doing it for your best interest. They're not doing it to kind of wind you up. But I think it does take a lot of acceptance.
Yeah, I imagine they must get that quite a lot, that people are just kind of resistant because it's all come as such a shock. And, you know, suddenly you're the person that's telling someone you have to have this operation and this procedure. Yeah. And there must be loads of people that are just like, no.
Yeah, I love it as well. Like the patience that you like, not the patience as in a patient, as in the patience as in like the chill and like being so like supportive of you. Because I get quite nervous in like procedures and stuff like that. Like even getting like a catheter in my hand. That's wrong.
Yeah, a
cannula.
A catheter.
It's not
the wrong place.
Do you pee out of your hand now,
babes? No, make life a lot easier though.
Is that one of your side effects, mate? We need to talk to your surgeon.
Oh God, sprain. But like getting the cannula in, even like initially when I was going for my first scans, I was like, I'm really nervous. And rather than make you feel like a silly girl, they'd be like, it's all right. Like, what is it makes you nervous? And they'd be just so patient and kind. So even when I was throwing out the jokes, they knew it was to ease my own nerves and they'd like kind of do it with me. They were great.
Yeah.
They were really good.
Yeah, it's good because, I quite often will kind of sit there and, like I said, I don't like to make the medics feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Always thinking about other people. I'm always just like, I'll just wait until I've got out to cry and I'll just wait until I finish this chemo session to freak out in the corridor. And yeah, but I imagine they're probably quite entertained by people like you and like you two naughty pair.
But I do
just
think,
turn up and say anything.
I do think that... So we've talked about trust and I think we're going to come on to it anyway. I do think even if you trust your team and you have one of the, you know, you really trust their credentials and everything, you still have the right to challenge them and to question stuff, to get answers, to push kind of for explanations of things. And some people just don't want to know. But if you're the kind of patient that wants to know, then absolutely you should be in a position where you feel comfortable to say, well, why are you doing this? Like, what's the benefit? Or I read about this and so I have a mutation, for example, and I'd read that a particular type of chemo, which is the one I called the nuclear chemo, that just screwed my hands over, is much better for my mutation. And we actually had a very open, honest conversation. I was like, well, why aren't I on that? And he explained why I wasn't on it. And then we decided to put me on it. Not because it was my decision, because it was a clinical decision to do so, but it was done at the right time. And it was already in his mind.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an important thing to say as well. You know, having said that, you know, I don't like to offend medical people and, you know, kind of do what I'm told. I think I've also very much questioned decisions. And I think, you know, if you do have a little bit of knowledge, obviously a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. But, you know, you should feel it's your care, it's your treatment, it's your body that's being treated. You should feel able to ask questions and, you know, question, why they are giving you a particular type of chemo. And generally things are, you know, explained because, you know, their level of knowledge is just way, way above ours. And when they explain it, it all makes sense. But I did actually change my medical team kind of halfway through. And it's something a lot of people look into is getting a second opinion.
Yep.
And when it came to that point that I wanted to get a second opinion, and I did it because my case was so complicated and I just kind of wasn't really sure where we were. And I think if you do lose trust in your medical team, you don't have anything. Yeah. You can't really go forward with that relationship. So I did go for a second opinion. And something that Steve talked about in the podcast last week that, you know, I'm always afraid of insulting the medical team. And so for me, it was just against everything that I would normally do, that I was kind of, all right, well, how do I go about this? And I don't want that surgeon and that oncologist to think that I think they're rubbish, but I'm just going to, you know, get opinion, because medical opinion is just that, it's opinion.
It is an opinion. There and is... people treat things in different ways.
Exactly. They have very different ways of doing things. Yeah. They have specialities. Some people have seen presentations in a similar way or a different way. They'll have like had successes where other people haven't even tried things. So you really do. If you're feeling that there may be other options, you just want to know.
And did you actually, are you now with that second team?
Yeah. So I changed onto a different team. So
it is all through the NHS, because my understanding, we do, everybody has a right on the NHS to kind of choose, or
almost like pick who you want, really. And you know, if you're not happy with the team that you're given, or you're not happy going to the particular hospital that you get sent to, then you are perfectly within your rights. You can either ask your GP or your current medical team to write a letter of referral. You do need that. You can't just turn up. I would demand an appointment now to see this particular
oncologist. I think I downloaded my x-ray from last year.
I actually went out and spoke to a couple of different oncologists. I almost felt like I was doing some sort of interview process, right? You know, the job of Rachel's oncologist is up for grabs. Who's gonna do
it?
Who's
X factor? Yeah. Onc factor.
We're going to the highest bidder. How many years do you reckon you can give me, mate?
But you do need to find the team that you can relate to and that you do have that trust in. Mm. And you know, changing onto my new oncology team, and it is a very much a team that I'm under at the Christie. You know, I've got my one oncologist who's kind of in charge. I've only seen her like once, I think. When I go in, it tends to be this team, but it's the same people within the team, and they're brilliant people who run the team. So I kind of trust and almost feel better that there are a team looking at it.
I know this only relates to bowel cancer, but I can only assume it relates to other cancers. So the outcomes for somebody with stage 4 bowel cancer, once it's, in most cases, stage 4 bowel cancer will spread to the liver first, and then sometimes the lungs. That's kind of the general pattern, and then sometimes wherever else. But the thing that's really shocking is that on what they call multidisciplinary teams, which are basically, well, you guys know, but it's essentially where everybody from lots of different disciplines will sit down and look at your case. There was research that Bowel Cancer UK did to actually realise that in the room, people were not, say, a liver specialist. So say somebody who had cancer that had gone to their liver wasn't being considered by a liver specialist. They were being looked at by, say, a bowel specialist. Mm. It basically changes the outcome. So I think you need to be really careful to ensure that, say, if you're at the stage where your cancer has spread, is your case being considered by the specialist that can deal with that spread?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I always felt better when I moved. So I started off at a small hospital near me, then moved to a bigger one, and then the hospital that I'm under just as the surgery. So I'm at the Christie for my oncology needs. I kind of felt better being at a bigger hospital. Again, you know, it's that thing that I just talked about, having a team of people, like more eyes on the case, the better. You know, the more opinions, I think, you know, the more of these expert minds that are looking at it and coming up, you know, and having, you know, if they do have a discussion, have a heated debate about what's the best way to go, it almost feels better to have more people looking at it.
I say to people, because I get, well, we all get loads of messages, because I appreciate some of the operations I've had, it isn't, you know, as routinely,
the best practice,
you know,
yeah,
like isn't routinely practice. Accessible. And people say, well, you know, how did you do that? And I haven't paid for it, but I will say, I would always ask your oncologist, if I had all the money in the world, would you still be treating me in the same way?
Yeah.
Because what I would want to know is, right, if money wasn't an issue, and I appreciate it is, but, you know, now, unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, people are crowdfunding left, right and centre, and I totally support that. But, you know, you want to know that money isn't holding back anything.
Yeah, because that, I mean, that, is, on the that table. Is the sad state of affairs. Yeah. You know, yeah. Just the way that the NHS doesn't have unlimited funds, and you know, it is different depending on where you live, and different health trusts will have different pathways and things that they will pay for and things that they won't.
My chemo, my second route, like my second bout, my second drug, was a prime example of this, like, economy of scale kind of thing with the NHS. I was told I was going to go into paclitaxel as my second four rounds, and actually I went into a room and they were like, Lauren, alongside Herceptin, we want to give you this drug called Perjeta, which is like a big sister of the Herceptin drug, but in order to do that, they had to put me onto doxorubicin, which is like Domestos of chemo. It's not the best. Like, that's the one I felt all of the symptoms with. And I just burst out crying. And I was a bit like, why? And they were like, because, and they were really honest, like, because for them to be able to like fund it to give you that better antibody drug, they have to then give you the cheaper chemo.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm like, okay, I understand. But you know, that is how it works.
Yeah,
and it's
a payoff for all of these things.
Yeah, and I'm glad, because at the end of the day, it did what it needed to do. And it might not have, but it was sitting in that room and being like, oh my God, like, you're kind of almost at mercy of money.
Yeah. And sometimes I think, you know, a little bit of knowledge. We talked about Dr. Google when all the boys were in last week, and how that can kind of send you down a dodgy path. Knowing too much can be bad, but at the same time, actually having a bit of knowledge about what's available can sometimes save you, because if you ask for something, you know, I've asked for something, so we talked about the Zoladex before, and it wasn't prescribed for my situation, but I wanted it to try and preserve my fertility, and I was told it wasn't available, and I pushed and asked because I knew that people in other NHS areas were getting it, and then I was given it. And it's things like that if you know about them and you know to ask, and you are confident enough to email your oncologist, your surgeon, your medical team and ask for it, then, you know, you can change your treatment.
And it's also with Dr. Google, it's just being careful. Like, you can Dr. Google, you can look at treatment stuff, you can go on like proper like the cancer websites, cancer charity websites. I think the danger comes when you go into forum world. I think if you're looking at actual papers and actual studies and things like that, you're all right.
Absolutely.
But yeah, be careful on forum world.
Yeah, be careful where you source your knowledge from. Mm-hmm. Well, I've mentioned him a couple of times already, talking about my medical team. We can actually talk to my surgeon, Richard Johnson, is on the line now. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Hi, Richard.
Hi. Okay.
Welcome. You're on with Deborah and Lauren as well.
So lovely to speak to you. Thank you for taking
you
care
too.
Of our Rachel.
We've heard loads about you.
Oh. Dear.
good things.
Yeah.
I mean, how have you found me as a patient?
You were going through, you know, quite a difficult period when you came to see me beforehand, and you know, there was probably a lot of questions and going around in your mind, and you asked me about our relationship, you know, the doctor patient, and quite early on it was clear that you know you're very intelligent, charming lady.
Oh, look at you.
You know.
But yeah, I was going to say, is it your surgeon or PR, mate?
You know, you're bright and you were always going to have a lot of questions.
How do you find it with people like me and like Deb says that she's done with her team, people who turn up armed with a little bit of knowledge? Do you find that quite annoying as a medical person?
No,
or no,
you didn't have a little bit, you had quite a lot of knowledge, actually.
I'm an expert.
I think, you know, it's like my dad, really. You know, he's Mr. Google, you know, and my brothers, and they all go on Google and they become experts, and then they come to me to just sort of confirm what they've read is right, and most of the time it isn't actually right, and they go for the very rare things rather than the common things, and they just think I dismiss them, but in your case. You know, it's quite a complex thing, breast cancer.
Yeah.
And, you know, nowadays with Google, most people will Google some form of it and come up with what they think's wrong with them and what they think the treatment is. But actually with breast cancer, it's quite personalised these days. And we can sort of tailor treatments depending on the biology of your tumour, so what it looks like down the microscope. And, you know, for the future, that's a really, really good thing. But going back to your question about knowledge, you have to deal with it, really. You know, there's a wide spectrum of people that come in who have absolutely no knowledge. They don't want to know they've got cancer. They just want you to take the lump out of the breast and then never see me again.
Yeah, just want the basics.
Yeah, they just don't want to know. Because
I've gone for super luxe.
Yeah, they can't comprehend it.
Value for money.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, there are the Rachels and they, you know, who do the reading that the young women, they're worried and they want to know, you know, what's going to happen to them. So they do as much reading as they can. So it's about me listening then to what you understand about what's happening to you and your body. And then if I can signpost you or if it needs corrections of your perceptions of what's going to happen or what type of disease it is, what treatment is expected, what happens if this goes wrong or, you know, so it's more of confirming that you understand what you've read.
Yeah. Do you find like in that respect, do you find then that, you know, depending on the patient, if they come armed with knowledge or not, like, do you find you change your manner depending on who the patient is? Or is that just like, do you think you're the same with everyone? Because we were just saying, like, I'm quite informal. So like the things I come out with, it was my surgeons.
I would have sworn at you by now.
And that wasn't me being like rude. Yeah. It's just me being a bit panicked and nervous. And I always try and make light of things when I'm scared. So it's like, how do you find that? Because you may have one spectrum, end of the spectrum's Rachel, the other end's me. So
yes. Well, yeah. I think it goes on your personal skills and communication skills as a doctor, as a human being, and how you view other fellow human beings. A lot of it, I think, comes from your upbringing. It comes from the training that you've had, and how you empathise is so important. And we see such a wide spectrum of people, and you have to cater for all those emotions, you know, the patients that might eff and blind at you, like you say, or get very nervous and say things they don't mean. And the way I approach that is just to listen to them, let them speak, let them tell me exactly how they're feeling, swear as much as they like, don't interrupt them, and then I'll ask some pertinent questions about what do you understand by the disease you've got, what have you been told so far, this is the treatment we recommend, and let you do the speaking, really, and let you ask as many questions as we can and guide you through it. So you adapt, and you have to adapt your communication style as well, because if I start screaming and shouting and swearing like you do, then it quickly becomes
things escalate.
You know, and not a very productive consultation. And of course, you know, we don't have hours to sit there in clinic. Mm. So you have got to get certain bits of information over.
Yeah. And have you kind of worked on, is it a conscious process, the way that you deliver news? Because Steve, my husband, always says, like, Mr. Johnson could tell you that the world was going to end tomorrow. And the way that he kind of delivers the news and the way you say, right, you know, this has happened, it's bad, but this is what we're going to do to deal with it. That actually, you know, you end up feeling like, oh, well, this is all right. It was bad news, but, it's okay. Mm. We're going to fix it.
It's a really fine line, Rachel, because, you know, it's about how I'm wired, I think, as a person. And surgeons generally don't want to give in and be defeated, and they want the best. All doctors want the best for the patient. Mm. But I think once the surgeon, you know, you put in front of a surgeon and you've done operations on them, you get that kind of bond and you know, you want really the best treatment for them. And it's... I'd like to think it's not like an algorithm with me, but you know, if someone comes with a problem, my brain sort of wired, I need to fix this, if I can. I need to fix it. So how am I going to do it? And before you walk into the room, I've already worked out how I'm going to do it.
Yeah, you've got a plan.
So I have a mental checklist before I come in and see a patient, and this is what I think is going to happen, unless the patient sort of throws a curveball and says, well, I don't want any treatment, or... You know, I think,
does
I think,
that happen very often that people just...
Yeah, well, so
we're talking about Deb throwing her toys out the pram earlier on and saying, I don't want a port put in, I don't want this, I don't want that. Do you get many people that kind of just say, nope, not doing it?
Not that many, but we do. There's a few on the books, who don't want it. And for whatever reason, you know, religious reasons come up and all sorts of other reasons. And they you know, we've got patients who go all around the world with alternative therapies seeking very expensive treatment often. that's you know, of no clinical value at all, and they eventually come back to the clinic, you know, conceding, as it were, that, well, I've tried that and nothing's helped. Can you
actually, we'll let you get on with it.
Yeah, can you come and sort me out now, please? But, you know, it, in their mind, it's very valid reasons why they don't want treatment. Of course, you get older ladies who, you know, bless them, I've had a good innings, love, you know, I'm all right, I don't want anything doing, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, but fortunately in breast cancer, in that group, in the older group, you can actually give them medication, a tablet to control it, and they don't necessarily have to have surgery. And that's not an ageist thing, that's just a patient decision.
Yeah, about the kind of level of intervention.
Yeah, so we do get some people who don't want treatment, but and they are quite complex, because you've got safeguarding issues then of, you know, well, why don't you want it? You know, you're probably going to die if we don't treat you. You know, are you a vulnerable adult? Have you got any issues, mental health issues that we need to think about? So that's really when your breast care nurse comes in, the GP, and, you know, you make sure that they fully understand what you're actually saying and diagnosing them with.
We were talking earlier on, so you were my second opinion. I switched and changed to be under your care. How do you find it, and doctors as a whole, how do they find it when somebody wants to go and get a second opinion? Because, you know, as doctors, you're pretty confident people. You've got to be confident in your own abilities to do what you do.
Yeah.
So is there any level of offence that's taken, or do you totally understand when somebody wants to go and get a second opinion?
I think there's probably a low level of, oh, am I not good enough?
Yeah, what have I done wrong?
Sort of thing, you know, what have I done wrong? And some people really take it personally. I don't. And we, at the Nightingale, we are a pretty big centre, and we have quite a lot of second opinions. It's not unusual for us to have, you know, one or two in the clinic. And they may come all from all over the place. And it goes along the lines of, I've been to see a doctor or surgeon at Hospital X. These are my mammograms. I've got DCIS or whatever. I want you to check that I've got this diagnosis. I want you to check if I need a mastectomy or not, and if I need my lymph glands removing. And actually, they want to give me some chemotherapy first. Is that the right thing to do? So what we do then, we review all the images and all the pathology in one of our big team meetings that we have with our oncologists and pathologists together, and we go through it all until we come up with an answer.
Yeah, and we were just talking about that, actually, about those MDT meetings and the importance of having just, like, loads of eyes on your case.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes.
You know, all the experts having a bit of a chat about it. Yeah.
It's not just a chat either. We get into the real detail, and we thrash it out. There's good going rouse almost in the MDT.
But that's kind of what you want, though.
Yeah, but for a good reason. Not, you know, we're not arguing for the sake of it, because sometimes, you know, in medicine there is grey areas, and there are grey areas in cancer and in the radiology, because no single test is perfect. No mammogram is perfect, as you know. You know, we might need another test like an MRI, and then we might pick something else up that we sometimes do in the second opinion. We pick another cancer up in the other breast or in the same breast. So, you know, because they've come to what you would probably call a tertiary breast unit, where, you know, we've got expertise in managing these things, we really do have to go to town on all those, you know, reviewing the imaging, reviewing the pathology, so we get the right answer.
Yeah, and that's the main thing. That's what everybody's after at the end of the day, is getting the right
Indeed.
Answer. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us, Richard. Is this the first time that a patient has dragged you onto a podcast?
It is, but it's great. Talking to patients, and, you know, especially what you've been through, if it helps, you know, I'm more than happy. But
Richard, can I just ask you before we let you go? So Deborah here, and I my cancer spread, so I went from stage 3 to stage 4, and my oncologist was absolutely brilliant. So I have bowel cancer, and the day that he told me, he'd already knew what the plan was. So sitting in the room was the lung surgeon. It had gone to my lungs, and the lung surgeon was there, and then the lung surgeon told me that he was going to operate on me in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
However, I absolutely appreciate that, because I knew that, yes, my cancer had spread, my statistics had plummeted, but there was a plan of action. Now, sometimes there's not a plan of action because you know in your professional judgment that there's kind of not really much more that you can do for this patient. How do you personally deal with that? And how maybe do you deliver that to somebody as well?
That's probably the most difficult part of the job. And I, how do I deal with it? I get quite upset inside.
Yeah.
And try and just try before I go in to think, is there any other thing I can do that we've missed? And if it really is, there's no other treatment, then I'll go in with my breast care nurse, and I won't use harsh terms.
Yep.
Yeah, I try and avoid, you know, there's nothing else for us to do, that's it, bye, goodbye, you know. I don't have a prescription for that scenario. I really don't.
Yeah, and it's nice to hear that it's obviously something, you know, you're not a machine. You have, you know, you have feelings and emotions about these things. And
and then I'll go home and it will, you know, those sorts of cases do stick in my mind. I don't tend to take my work home, but those sorts of decisions and cases do go on in my head quite a lot, because it's really difficult for the patient. But you know you're almost admitting defeat, and I don't do defeat.
Yeah, as a medical person, you're always trying to fix it.
That's good to hear, though, isn't it? I love hearing that, because I think my oncologist would probably be the same. It's kind of, no, what else can we do? What else can we do? What's next? What's next? What's next?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, trying to think about if you were my wife or my mother. That's always how I try and treat patients, really, or try and deal with bad news.
Yeah, which is exactly what you want. Thank you
so much, Richard. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you.
And you know, I'll be dropping you a text again sometime soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Richard.
Bye-bye.
Oh, now I know why you love him so much. He's the best.
He's just lovely, isn't he? And just his that manner.
I feel calm.
Measured.
I feel very chill.
Yeah, yeah. There's no panic involved and no, like...
But also very matter-of-fact.
Yeah.
But in a... I think it's the person. I think it's who you are as a human.
Yeah.
He's clearly very passionate.
Yeah. And that's what I needed was just someone like him who is very matter-of-fact, but at the same time very obviously cares. Mm. You know, he's not at that scientific level of matter-of-fact, like, oh, whatever. We're talking a bit with him about kind of, you know, being in charge of your own care and going in with that bit of knowledge. How much did you girls want to know? Were you kind of... Because you really went to town.
Like, I am the person that goes into my oncologist and says, have you just read the Beacon 3 trial? What do you think about this? Because I read not just kind of Google. I go into the medical journals, the approved medical journals. I read the ASCO reports, left, right and centre. And I mean, arguably, I go a little bit OTT on it. I know that I do, and then I know I have to stop. But for me, I go in with a kind of... I think quite a good understanding, but what that's enabled me to do with my oncologist is to have a relationship that is quite a medical kind of relationship.
So you're almost sort of debating the medical
pros.
Absolutely.
So as we talked earlier in the podcast, I've just been given a clear scan, and we did in the same sentence have a conversation about maintenance chemo. And we had, you know, he gave me a week to think about it. I went away and read loads of reports. He went away and had a really good think about it. We agreed that there isn't a case like me in a textbook, which I thought, well, you know,
obviously.
Always near as special. But what it enabled us to do is just to have a very kind of on the same level conversation where I had kind of some say in terms of what we felt was best, and the decision that we made moving forward was incredibly close monitoring.
Yeah.
And because there are research reports that argue for and against. And so for me, I was at the point where nothing was enforced upon me in terms of, you know, well, him saying, well, I think you need to have more chemo, and me going, I really don't want more chemo. But me also saying, I want more chemo, and him going, well, hang on a moment. Mm. There's not really research, you know, for and against.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was just a really good, honest kind of place to be.
Because I was sort of, I think I was a bit somewhere in the middle, in that I go in, I want to be informed. I want to know what is being done to my body and yeah, what, you know, same. What are the best options here. But then I also don't want anyone to tell me anything bad. So I'm just like, let's not talk stats. Let's not talk about, you know, prognoses or anything else. Let's just talk about what's happening and, you know, what our options
are
now.
Exactly same as you. I went in, but like, as I said, I was like, I don't want to die. They said I'm not going to. So I took that at face value that I'm going nowhere. This is just going to be a really tough ride. So I went in, like, I want to know the drugs you're giving me, why you're giving them to me, why I'm not having certain other drugs, what it's going to do to my body, why is it doing that to my body? Like, I ask all the questions. And then, like, when it was finished and I went into my oncology meetings and I actually sat there and I went, what are my statistics? And they went, do you want to know? And I said, yeah. And they worked it out with my, like, you know, the drugs that I had, my age, all the factors they
do. They've got, like, a computer system that can, like, plug in all your stats and give you a number.
Yeah, and they were like, and my response to the chemo and response to my treatment, and they were like, right, so do you want to know the percentage of your recurrence, like percentage rate for recurrence in your case? And I just went, no.
Yeah.
And I'd made them go away, bless them, and do it all. But then I went, no, don't tell me, because that number will stick in my head.
Yeah. And it does nothing. It has no bearing on how things will turn out. Yeah.
And that's how I'm living my life. Yeah. If it rears its head, I'll deal with that then. But in that respect, I like to stick my head in the sand. And also in that same respect, I like to not stick my head in the sand. I'm very aware of, like, people around me. Like, we've had, like, the lovely Amy, didn't we? Her case. And that was close to you. Yeah. And I think it's things like that.
Amy Mattingly.
Yeah, Amy Mattingly.
Yeah, who had bowel cancer.
But I
know about them. And I read about them and I'm very aware of their stories. But I try not to dig too deep because I just feel like it does you no good.
Yeah,
but
I think self-preservation.
I think there is a compromise, because the thing that frustrates me a little bit is when, so A, terminology, but that's a whole different podcast in itself, in terms of when people use I'm terminal, I'm not terminal. I'm like, well, who's told you that? And have you given up already? I just don't use that word. And on top of that, I think I find it amazing where if you're given a terminal diagnosis, which is essentially, well, you know, I always say, well, who's given you that diagnosis? Yeah. And then there was a lady I was speaking to, I'm not going to name names, the other day, who kind of is raising some money, right, for a particular, well, raising some money for her children. And I, she messaged me and I messaged her back and I said, I'm not being funny, but you're raising some money for your kids. So if you were to pass away, they're going to have a good life. Why aren't you using that money to fund Avastin, which is a drug that isn't available in the NHS, which is probably the next stepping stone for most people.
Chemotherapy work.
Absolutely. Or she has liver mets. So why aren't you funding it to look into CERT, or at least getting second opinions? Oh, it's just too much, was her response. I don't want to look into it. But I don't know, maybe that is just my view, in that I would use any money that I have fundraised to make damn sure that I am pumping it into every possible treatment, left, right and centre. And then if it was, and that's exactly what Amy did, and that's why I absolutely supported what she was doing. She was very well researched. She knew that the kind of the treatment option that she was fundraising for was something not available in the NHS.
Yeah,
and I just think... I don't know. I do think that there's a level of knowledge that can really, it can help people live and it can give people access to things. But you can only do it if you do Google.
That. Yeah. And if you're open to it and you speak to other people.
You speak to other people. Yeah.
Well, let's talk to a man now who has very much been living since his cancer diagnosis. John Hartson. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thank you so much.
We
finally got you on the podcast, John. Talk us through your story then, because it's been quite a while now. It was very well publicised. Was it back in 2009 you were diagnosed?
Yes, well, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer in 2009. And what it was, I was aware of lumps on my testicles probably for 3 or 4 years before I actually went and got the actual diagnosis.
So 3 or 4 years. Were you aware that whole time that something probably wasn't quite right?
Towards the very end, I was. Probably in the last 3 or 4 months, I was maybe thinking, well, the tumour had gone from like a nut size on one of my testicles to now it was like more of a Malteser size. So I was almost expecting the news that I got. I then started to have regular headaches, and they weren't just like a normal headache where you can take a couple of paracetamol and they would generally go away. It was like your worst migraine ever. It was like it was horrendous. The headaches. I couldn't face the light. I couldn't put my head on the pillow. So I actually went to my local GP, and she prescribed me with sachets of paracetamol. Mm-hmm. And my head was almost on her desk, you know. And then my sister came to the house, and we thought that I had swine flu, because that was around at that particular time when I was going through my particular problem. But then my sister said, look, I'm going to take you to the hospital. And then when I arrived in the hospital, I almost collapsed. I passed out. I was violently sick, and my sick was black.
Must have been absolutely terrifying at that point.
And then my father, who arrived at the hospital a couple of hours later, he could actually hear me from three floors down, the squelches and the way that I was bringing this sick up. It was horrendous. And then I was eventually diagnosed with testicular cancer that had spread to my lungs and onto my brain. And over the next 6 weeks, then I was in and out of theatre. I had two emergency brain operations. I had over 60 sessions of chemotherapy. I caught pneumonia on the ward, which nearly cost me my life. Not so much the cancer; it was the pneumonia, because I'd had all this chemotherapy, the chemotherapy attacks them horrible red cancer cells, but it also attacks them lovely nice white cells that keep you alive. So my immune system was literally down to nothing. When I got the pneumonia, I just basically could not stop coughing, and they thought that cough was going to take my life. And that affects a lot of elderly people. Not the cancer battle, but it's the pneumonia, it's the chemotherapy, because it destroys your immune system.
Yeah, and I mean, how difficult was that? It just sounds as though you went from being this kind of, you know, healthy sportsman, suddenly from, you know, 0 to 60 in a matter of weeks, you suddenly went from being this young, fit guy to, you know, a really, really quite sick cancer patient who was, you know, bedridden in hospital.
Yeah, well, it was obviously very shocking for my wife and my children and my close friends and family. But if I'm being truthfully honest with you, it wasn't just since I was diagnosed. It was my wife said to me that she used to look at me and think, you know, you don't look well. You know, I'd had a lot of, I'd put on a fair bit of weight. My eyes were sort of back. You know, withdrawn back in the sockets, if you like. She said, used to say things that just didn't make sense. And it's only like your wife that can, you know, actually tell you these things, because you spend so much time with each other. Whereas my friends probably didn't notice that side of me. So I think it was a case of it was in me, but it was spreading without my knowledge. Mm-hmm. And then eventually it was the headaches that forced me to go into hospital. And then over that 6 weeks, I was rushed down to theatre for two major brain operations. And I was very blessed to have come through that period. And then I went on to a chemotherapy programme, which I lost an awful lot of weight. And then eventually I started to get stronger. So I feel immensely grateful I was able to come through my personal battle, because I know there's a lot of people out there that, you know, it turns people's lives around, it does cancer, and not everybody gets the luck. Not everybody gets, you know, the chemotherapy reacted fantastically well. My body reacted fantastically well to the chemo. And I think that's the key, you know, and I slowly got stronger, and gradually And I've been going back and forth now for the best part of 10 years for scans and CT scans. And I'm almost at a place now where they'll basically discharge me completely. It's 10 years, testicular cancer. It was 2009. But I'm in a great place now. And, you know, I do as much as I can to raise awareness. And I've set up the John Hartson Foundation, which... it's a cancer based charity.
Yeah, you've kind of devoted your sort of a lot of your time to raising awareness of this, something that, you know, you yourself had kind of ignored the symptoms of, trying to prevent anybody else from ending up in that same situation.
Well, that's right. It's not so much about raising money. I have to tell people that, because there's people worth £30 million who don't give a penny to charity. It's about the message. It's about the awareness. It's going early. When you feel a lump, or when you've got any sort of, you know, things that you're not sure of, you've got to go and get checked. You know, you've got to go, and if you're a woman, you know, smear tests. And men, you can almost tell now everything by a urine sample. It is so, so simple. I went for a urine sample a couple of weeks ago for my life insurance. And basically, I give him a urine sample, and the doctor said to me, "Do you want to know if you've got prostate cancer?"
Wow. Yes. Well, that'd be handy, yes. Love, wouldn't it?
I said, "Yes, I'd like to know." So he dipped this little colour chart into my urine, and he went, "No, John, you're clear. You're clear of that. It's men generally in their 50s. I'm only 43. But it was that simple.
Yeah.
And that's the key. It's raising the awareness. And of course, if you can raise some money, which you can give back into the hospitals. I listened to you before I came on. You know, that helps with research and technology. And if it helps to buy some new chemotherapy chairs for the unit, then... You know, it's all good. It's all good karma as well, isn't it?
We've been kind of talking on the podcast today about our relationships with our doctors and our medical team. How did you approach that relationship with your team? It sounds like you probably had quite a big team looking after you in the end.
Well, it was more, if I'm honest, it was more my oncologist than the surgeon, because the surgeon has a job to do, and you basically put your trust in the surgeon. It's the oncologist that becomes more of your friend. He's the one who's talking to you almost every day. He'll pop into the ward. Your parents will be there. He'll give them all a bit of an update. What's going on? What's the next procedure? Whether it's more chemo, whether it's another operation, whether it's rest, whether it's, you know, whatever, whether it's a scan. So it was more... I became ever so friendly with my oncologist, Dr. Bartelli, in Singleton Hospital in Swansea. He almost became like family.
Yeah, it's weird.
And it's extraordinary, because he's dealing with... You almost get... I always find it like a nurse that delivers babies. It's like they deliver 10, 15 babies every day. But when they deliver your wife's baby, you want to take them flowers and you want to thank them because they're healthy baby. It's like your oncologist. They are dealing with another 50 people on the same ward.
Yeah. You know, as far as you're concerned,
to you, they're only dealing with you.
Yeah.
They become your main source of information, your main source of support. But he's off from me. He's going to see the lady who's... got her own problem in the next bed, and then he's across the way seeing. But he becomes so personal, and he's a fantastic man. I still keep in touch with him now. So that was the main relationship I had with him, which was a very, very close one. And I've also got to say as well that there was times when I looked like I was going to lose my battle. You know, my eyes were big, rolling in the back of my head, and I was feeling very, very low. And he would then say to my mum and dad, "Look, John's got a major brain operation to come. We are not quite sure whether John's going to come through this." So they're not the most positive. It was strange, only they're not the most positive of people, because if they actually think something, they have to be totally honest with you. They cannot tell you anything that maybe will, you know, perk up your confidence.
False sense of security.
They will just tell you, and they'll tell the people around you that He's got a big battle on his hand. We're extremely, extremely concerned with John's condition. It's looking very, very touch and go. And my parents are like, wow, do you know, that's the last they want to hear. But he has to be honest. That's his job. That's what they're very good at.
And in that respect, then, did you kind of gain a lot of respect for them in the long run? Because obviously you had a hell of a lot of treatments, a hell of a lot of surgeries and a very long process. So I think, did you then go, okay, do you know what? I trust what you're doing. It's working. I'm with you and I'm fine that you'll be matter of fact with me.
Oh, huge respect. Absolutely huge respect because, you know, they can only tell you how the scans are. You know, they don't necessarily save lives, the oncologists, the surgeons, you know, and if the cancer generally goes to the wrong part of the body, if the cancer goes into your blood, up to your brain, into your bones, there is no oncologist, there is no surgeon, there is nobody, I'm very, very sorry, that is going to keep you alive because cancer doesn't discriminate and you need that little bit of luck. I'm a big believer in when you are going through cancer and the chemo and meetings with the oncologist, spending time in hospital, you need the cancer, you need the chemotherapy to work, you need it to have an effect on your body. And I think positivity, it helps if you're positive, but cancer has taken a lot more and stronger and more positive men than me in its time. So I think you always need that little bit of luck. And and for me, I got that big piece of luck, which I think you need, not just when you're going through cancer, but I think you need that in life in general.
I totally agree with the luck thing is, you know, some people are like, you can do this, you're so positive. And I'm thinking, I know loads of positive people who didn't quite work out.
It doesn't always
work.
But John,
absolutely.
I think, you know, well, we all think you're great. I saw a lot of you.
I wondered when we get onto this.
Very, very, very recently on the Full Monty. I have to say, no offence, but I did kind of pause on slow-mo a little bit. And was that on purpose, the way that you were standing?
No, it wasn't on purpose at all. Actually, people say to me now, John, we don't recognise you with your clothes on.
Was that as nerve-wracking as going, like, into chemo? I mean, which was the scariest bit?
A little bit anxious and a few nerves. But you know what? We've all got one.
You do. I was going to say you've got three ladies here who don't.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's fair to say you got your fair share.
It was great fun, and it was watched by 6.2 million people,
which is amazing.
And, people have since said to me that while the show was on, they were going to the toilet to check themselves.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic! Important.
Which is just exactly what you would have wanted
the girls,
from that.
Colleen Nolan and all the other girls and Derbyshire, they were amazing as well. You know, we hooked up a few times. The girls did it the night before, we did it the night after, and I have to say a huge credit to them as well, and for ITV for putting the show on, because the awareness, the amount of people that watched it, the amount of people that have since gone and got themselves checked, and ultimately it will save people's lives, that one particular show.
I think props to you all for doing that, because as a breast cancer patient, I rate the girls for putting themselves out there and doing that and raising that awareness, because you know, it's so important, and thank you for doing it, mate.
Yeah. John, thank you for giving us the opportunity to, you know, raise that awareness. Well, for you guys to raise that awareness and to pause on your bit. It's brilliant, isn't it?
Sorry about Deborah.
Sorry about Deborah. Lowering the tone.
You know what? When you have cancer, John, as you are fully aware, you have to you have to take the laughs, don't you?
You do. I think you have to, you know, you have to try and remain positive when it's very, very extremely difficult, and sometimes you're feeling very low and you're awaiting an operation. The chemotherapy is an awful experience, you know, the side effects and things. But you know what? I think sometimes as well, you know, it is what it is. I think whatever hand you're given, you know, I genuinely believe a lot of people, you know, when we are born, we are given a number. And I think when your number's up, my number wasn't up. It wasn't my time to go. And unfortunately, I'm not a particular religious person, but, you know, I do think that, you know, it's all in the stars. It's all written out for us. And I wasn't meant to leave this place at this particular time.
Absolutely not. We needed to keep you around to do the full Monty.
And other people just quite don't get that little bit of luck, which is terribly unfortunate. My heart goes out to everybody that's, you know, lost their battle, and people that have lost friends and family. It's horrendous, and it affects the family as much as it affects the patient.
Yeah, well, John, keep doing what you're doing. The foundation has been a brilliant thing, and we know we're all about raising awareness here. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks for
Good to talk
Take
to
care.
You. Bye, John.
Bye.
Can I just say something?
Not
about his penis.
Okay,
I'm not talking about his penis anymore. It's had enough airtime, I believe.
I'm gonna. You guys carry on. I'm gonna go for a wee quickly. I've been holding it in the whole time. That's live podcasting.
This is the first time for the podcast.
Fine. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I really couldn't hold that.
Well, that's a bit of a magic of podcasting, isn't it?
She's back.
That
was a quick wee.
That was quick. My heels 3 times, done.
And here she is.
Wee free.
Wee three.
So our top 5 tips for dealing with doctors. Number one, I'm going to say don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, it's your care, it's your treatment. You can ask and they will always do their best. Yeah. As we heard from my surgeon, they always do their best to kind of answer those sort of things.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then definitely write things down. I know we spoke about this on previous podcasts, how my sister took the role of medical secretary, because a lot of the time when you go into these meetings, it is a lot to take in and a lot to take on, and you might not ask the right questions or they might not be in your head at the time. So it's always good to write things down so you can come back to them and go away and think about them, or bring someone with you who can do that job for you.
Yeah. Number 3 is you can question their opinions. I have an oncologist who I think is one of the best in the world at what he does. I will still challenge him and question him, you know, and why not? And
Do you know more than your oncologist?
Are you sure I don't know more than you from Dr. Google?
Yeah, you're the one who's living in your body.
Absolutely.
And I always say this, you know, I'm the only one who's been at all of my medical appointments.
Yeah.
I've been to every single one. I've spoken to every medical expert, and, you know, I've retained some of the knowledge that they tell me, which kind of runs into number 4, really, that I'd say, you know, ultimately you're in control of your care. So, you know, feel that you can take control if you want to. If you don't want to, that's fine. Be a passenger. Both are okay.
Number 5 then. So be open with them about how you feel. Yeah. I think this is, and be very, very honest. One example will be kind of, I had loads of chemotherapy. We all did. I have some side effects from it. I don't think I was as honest as what I kind of should have been, maybe, with some of the side effects. And as a result, probably, you know, I've got to the tipping point where I tipped it a little bit too far.
Yeah.
As I'm, you know, 20 times a day of the, I'm not going to say the S word, of the poos.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I should have been very honest about that earlier, for example. But just tell them actually how you feel.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening today. That's all from us for now. Remember, you can contact us. We'd love to hear from you. We are going to read out more of your messages next week. We've totally run out of time today.
I've got some lovely ones.
I feel like we should do them now. But next week we'll do a big message roundup next week. Use the hashtag YouMeBigC across whichever social media platform you wish to contact us on. If you would like to review the podcast, you can do that on your podcast provider. Please leave us a rating. Tell everybody about you, me and the Big C. We really appreciate all of your feedback. So thank you very much for all of you that have done that already as well. We're going to be back next week. That's all from us for now. Goodbye.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks for downloading the You, Me and the Big C podcasts.
Don't forget to click subscribe.
Or get more great podcasts from 5Live at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.